WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, September 16th. The Trump administration used Vice President J.D. Vance's guest hosting of the Charlie Kirk Show yesterday to threaten to bring down the federal government's hammer on what they call the radical left. Host Vance and his show guest Stephen Miller alleged there is a left-wing network that funds and incites violence, and that this requires a federal investigation. Neither Vance nor Miller substantiated their claims. Citing an unnamed administration official, the New York Times reported that investigations will focus on people behind the recent burning of Teslas and assaults against immigration agents and their links to organized liberal groups. Meanwhile, following the murder of Charlie Kirk, investigators are still working to identify a motive in the killing of the conservative campus organizer. The Republican governor of Utah has said that the suspect had a leftist ideology, but that he acted alone. The big aquarium next to the highway is ready to bow to the public. Moat Marine announced that Wednesday, October 8th, will be official opening day for its Science Education Aquarium. With that, the 70-year-old nonprofit completes the move of its educational branch from City Island to the $160 million-plus cruise ship-shaped building 6 miles from the bay. Moat says the new facility will teach more than 70,000 K-12 students every year about marine science. The student visits will be free of charge. Most of Moat Marine's research will still be done on City Island. One local official is ringing the alarm bells on the outgoing governor's plans to eliminate property taxes. At an event last week, Ron DeSantis said this is his top priority in the upcoming, his last, legislative session. Longboat Key Mayor Ken Schneier called the plans crazy talk. Property tax revenues make up 75% of the town's general fund budget. Without those revenues, places like Longboat Key would not have a police or a fire department, he said. The Manatee County Democratic Party has a new chair. Christine Kennedy Meyer was previously vice chair of communications. She and her husband have lived in Manatee County for more than 20 years, and they own a small business in Palmetto. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, September 16th.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is show 69 of Our Changing Environment. The previous show was Corduroy, hosted by Sebastian. I'm Julie Morris, and Jono is not joining us today, because we have a studio change, and the studio that we're in, Studio B, is not capable of having three people in it. Today, we're going to be chatting with longtime Sarasota resident and distinguished photographer Brad McCourtney. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. Brad, it's great to have you here in the studio. Let's start with your earliest memory of Sarasota. When would that have been?
Family moved down in 1951. I was born in St. Louis. About 6 months into that, I think my family said I was feeling poorly or something, and we moved to Sarasota. My grandparents were already here. So 51 would have been when we first moved down, and we moved out on Siesta Key, rented a cottage out there. I don't remember that, but I do remember from about age of three, four, five, still out on Siesta.
Okay, so let's talk about your photography career.
Okay.
So when did you start taking photographs of Sarasota and people in Sarasota?
Yeah, so I have to give a little bit of background. So When I was younger, still in high school, I had an interest in the arts, and I didn't know for sure which way I was going with it. I was enrolled in a couple of the art classes, and I used to hang out on St. Armand's after my mother died. I was living with my stepmother in St. Armand's, and I got to be good friends with Muffy Hiss. Muffy Hiss is the daughter of Philip Hiss, who's the noted developer of parts of the Sarasota School of Architecture, a developer of the different homes out on south end of Longboat and north end of St. Armand's Circle, that whole area, but I've forgotten the name of it. But anyway, Muffy and I were good friends, and she was a little bit of a wild child, and so was I, so we did a lot of palling out, boy-girl kind of thing, having fun. We were probably 14 at the time, maybe 15. And I got to know Muffy better and better. I started hanging out at the Hiss residence, and Philip Sr. was the noted person in that family, but he was also a very talented photographer. And in his home were these huge black-and-white photos of Bali. And I was just mesmerized by him. Every time I went over to visit Hiss's at the age of 15, I was pretty taken by these. So that was my interest, my early interest in photography. So from there, I got a couple jobs locally in Sarasota. One was with Lawrence Jake, a photographer, who paid me $1 an hour after school. And I also worked part-time for Joe Steinmetz, a noted photographer here also.
Okay, and then how did you develop from being paid a dollar an hour into photographing notable people and unnotable people in Sarasota?
Okay. I have to keep going back, Julie. I'm sorry. Because I have to put some kind of relevance to it. So what happened was after I graduated high school, I didn't know what to do. So I took off for England, hitchhiked to New York, got on a ship, went to England, and was accepted into an art school there and took the photography a couple more steps. So at that point, I started becoming more interested in people per se. So I was interested in more of doing stories about people and places, more of an editorial style. So in England, I would hang out with different people, different groups, photograph the local butcher or photograph a little circus that came through town or whatever. So that started my interest in other people's lives, you know, their story, the culture behind it, et cetera. So by the time I came back from England, after almost five years, I'd already established this whole interest in what Sarasota was, and also my interest in documenting certain social groups. So by the time I got back to England, in the States here, in Sarasota, my interest was really to document what I had grown up around, the people I knew, I'd heard of, noticed, people that were kind of odd and unusual, and particularly unique to Sarasota, because Sarasota, we had a lot of unique different cultures and different lifestyles. So that's what started it.
Okay, and so let's talk about the people that you did portraits of in your photography.
The individuals?
Yeah.
Okay, do you want to name some? Because I don't know where to start. There's
41
of them ended up in the show.
Okay.
So I tried to do a cross-cultural look at a five-county area, being Manatee, Sarasota, Charlotte, Lee, and Collier. So what I did is I hit the road, the back roads. These are really more like field portraits. The first four or five were actually studio portraits, and then I figured I need to go out into the field and do this. So I took a tape recorder, found people, asked if I could photograph them, and then some said no or yes, and I had to talk my way into it. But there were always people that interested me that I grew up around, and I didn't really even know why. It wasn't like I was determined to, you know, create a certain content. I just didn't know why I was doing this other than I was just so intrigued by these people, these heroes I grew up around, leaving England, leaving the States and going to England kind of brought all this kind of importance back to me, these people. So when I came back, I was excited. I started picking people. So I would pick people first. I picked a lot of rural cowboys, people out east of town. One in particular was Harvey Keene out at Pine Level, which was early Manatee County seat. He was one of the first field portraits I did. And then it went from there to there to find new and other people. I would ask around. So people would give me ideas or suggestions. So it was really almost a 40-year project. I'd maybe do 8 or 9 one year and only do 2 or 3 the next year.
Okay, and so some of the names of people you did portraits of, mm-hmm. it was the Rohr family.
Right.
Maynard Hiss,
right.
who was Philip Hiss's son,
mm-hmm.
and can you remember other people that you...
Yeah, if I go in chronological order, Julie, I could probably do it easier.
Okay.
There's so many people, like I said, and most of the people were actually became friends, even though there was a difference in ideology or interests in their background. I didn't really care. That wasn't part of what I was trying to do. I was just trying to document people I grew up around. So I would pick a lot of, I would say a lot of country folk that were really old Southern Democrats. So mm-hmm. when Julie, when you mentioned the Rohr family,
mm-hmm.
they always intrigued me. Now, I went to school with Tom. Tom Rohr was one of the sons of Rita's. And the three boys and dad and mom, they were very old Southern Democrats. In that sense, in the sense that they were prior to the Republican changes that we had in the county here, Southern Democrats still held a stronghold in politics and in certain boards, et cetera. And so I was always intrigued with Tom, who was a friend of mine, a buddy at Sarasota High School, his family. So when I got back, I said, Tom, I'd love to interview your mom and your dad, Don, and et cetera, et cetera. So I did that and got to know them a little bit more. And as you get to know people, they become open. I became more open and, you develop these friendships. So a lot of times I'd spend 3 or 4 days on a portrait or the field recordings or whatever, which sometimes the photography came first, sometimes it came last. So the Rohr family were an early portrait thing that I wanted to do to document what I thought was early Florida politics.
Yeah, and so eventually you went into business with your son, Matt, mm-hmm. is that right?
Yes.
And he was into digital photography.
Right.
And you had a dark room and you were into film photography, right?
Right.
Yep.
So what I've always been interested in the process. So photography to me was more of a craft. It wasn't like an art form. It was a craft. You learn the craft, and this is a traditional way of teaching, especially in Britain, that you apprentice, you learn this craft, you spend years doing it, and then you're accomplished, and then you can, actually do your own work in your own darkroom, your own photography, whatever. But it was a kind of a process you had to go through. Today it's very different. The digital is something that can be learned, very quickly, generally speaking, within a year, et cetera. But the craft part, I always was interested. So the darkroom was a big part of my life. So I spent a lot of time in the darkroom, all-nighters, just smoking and listening to Bob Dylan and cranking out prints. And I loved printing. I was a really good printer. So all of that became part of the process, whereas my son Matt, my older boy, he was always in a hurry, wanted to make a buck, and digital was just popping right then. Right around the area of 2000, the year of 2000. And he kind of went his own way, but I stuck with the darkroom. So I had the darkroom up until a year ago.
Okay, and so tell us what happened to your house in Hurricane Helene.
Okay. Julie, I had so much to say about the photography.
Okay, so tell me more about the photography.
Okay,
portraits.
Let's talk about the portraits, because there's some special people there that I grow very close to. All of them, actually, I became very close to, and even some of the ones that use some bad language and the N words and a few others. It all made something to me, and I saw the story early on, but I didn't know how to make a compilation, put it together, do something with it. So my whole point behind doing all the portraits was to put a book together and showcase what was unique about this west coast of Florida. So that was my whole ideal situation, was to put this all together in a large format, using a large format camera. All the camera was always the same. It was a big 8x10 field camera that I had made for me when I was in England. And the tape recordings, the field recordings, and much like some of the field recording that was done through the Library of Congress, et cetera, during the WPA and all that. So I was really interested in documenting the stories and people. So my interest there was always that, but it was always the introduction, the time spent interviewing people off camera, on camera, and then getting to know them. So that was my whole interest. When it came along with my son, his was more like, Dad, let's make some money at this, you know. And I said, well, sure, you know, because I'm not a businessman. So he took a run for it in the one area, which is digital. I stayed with the darkroom and the printing and spending time interviewing. So we kind of split that up. But the portraits were kind of a lifelong thing that I always wanted to do. And because of so many other people, and I saw other influences out there that when I was growing up, that books and other photographers that influenced me in my life and all that stuff seemed much more important than trying to do the digital and trying to do, you know, hurry and make a business out of it.
Yeah, so is there anything else that you want to say about your photography career?
No. I mean, we can talk about it. Julie, you're going to have to ask me questions. First of all, my photography was always under the name of J.B. McCourtney. So I have about five different pseudonyms, depending upon where I'm at or who I'm with. Like, Julie, you and John know me as Brad, and that's more of a familiar use of my name through family and friends, but I go by J.B., James, Bradford, Frank is another name I've been used, Jesus. So depending upon who I'm working with and where I'm at, so my photography's always been under the name J.B. McCourtney, and that's something that my father called me when I was very young. He used to call me J.B., so that's how that J.B. came about. But, yeah, sometimes people run into me, get confused, they don't know how to address me.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So, your mother died when you were 14, mm-hmm. and you spent some time hanging out with Eric and Kay von Schmidt's family.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Tell me about that.
So, I have to have a little bit of background again. So, when my mother and father were together, my father left about the age of when I was about age seven, and I'm not sure where he went. But my mother then be drinking and turning into an alcoholic. So my sister was sent away to school, boarding school in St. Louis. And so my mother and I lived together for the next 5-6 years, me taking care of her. So that was mostly on Siesta Key. So that started this whole process of trying to understand, you know, what was going on. But then all of a sudden I realized I'm kind of a loner anyway. So I just kind of didn't really have a lot of buddies or friends. So when my mother died in 1964, I was kind of left out in the open there. And again, being a little bit of a loner, I just didn't really reach out for help. So I started hitchhiking and living with a couple of different families. Some of them took me in because they thought it was important for my mother to have, you know, a guardian for me. That didn't work out. So I started roaming the Key and hanging out with different people out on the Key. One family in particular that reached out to me was Eric and Kay von Schmidt, and they lived on the beach at the time, a little cottage. So I would hang out over there. A couple other people, John Lambie, I think we mentioned his name, also had a home at the south end of Siesta called Mildew Manor. I would hang out there. And then I also would get up and just go hitchhike. So when I was finally ready to leave for high school, I was living with my stepmother out in St. Armand's, and this is where, going back to his family, I took off from there. I left Sarasota. My stepmother, who I love very much, took off from there and went to Britain. First summer I was there, I started hitchhiking across Europe, heading for North Africa. By the time I got back to school the first semester, my stepmother died, so that was one more kind of notch into the belt of, you know, being a loner. So it kind of affected me. All that stuff affected me. So go ahead, Julie.
So tell me how you've witnessed Siesta Key changing through the decades.
Yeah. You know, everybody knows this, but, you know, when you live at a certain time and you're living that life, you look back and say, oh, God, it was so great. But I don't remember it being that great other than just being, you know, a free walk through life. I don't know. I could do whatever I wanted. So I had, you know, a pelican. I had all sorts of strange stuff. But
you had pet pelican?
Yeah, pet pelican.
Yeah.
And that comes from an old character that from out-of-door school. There's a couple influences there. I went to out-of-door school from the age of 6 to I graduated from there in grade 8 to go on to Sarasota High School. But, yeah, it's an out-of-door school from 1956 through 1964, I believe. Yeah. So living out in Siesta was different back then, but it was beautiful. But, you know, you just didn't realize it. I mean, I remember the sand spurs. I remember the mosquitoes. Our first homes that we had on the island, there was no air conditioning, screen doors. You had floor fans and above fans, and you had to keep your dog in at night because of all the bobcats. And occasionally there'd be things like you'd have a snake in the yard or the house. Nobody could identify it, so we'd have to call Texas Jim Mitchell, and he'd have to come out to the house with a snake stick and stuff like that. And then the out-of-door school was a big part of my life because it was right there. I could walk to school. My dog went to school with me and slept underneath my desk. And so all that stuff, those are all great memories. Looking back at them, that they sound beautiful. They were at the time, I guess. But also, I was going through a little bit of a crisis. So I didn't really know exactly what was good and what wasn't good. And how was life treating me? I didn't know.
Yeah. And so contrast that with Siesta Key today.
I go over the bridge still because I have the home out on Siesta. We got flooded, and we had to leave. The house is kind of totally just, you know, gone. It's just a total loss. But anyway, I still cross the bridge, the North Bridge, and look out over the water and think, God, it's so beautiful here because there's something about the water. When I grew up in Sarasota, I was very young. I didn't have a car. I had a bicycle and I had a boat. And the two things got me around town. So I could take the boat all the way into town. At 12 years old, I was driving a boat, riding around, you know, downtown, et cetera, and docking up at the pier, you know, city pier there. So all that stuff was good stuff. Today, when you go over the bridge, it's just people yelling and screaming. I go into the village. I'm not comfortable. I feel out of place. A lot of rowdiness, I would say. And then there's a lot of the bar scene, and I even got involved in that myself. So I'm not taking a bad angle on the whole bar scene because I was guilty of it myself. But Siesta Key became much more involved with the tourist thing and a little bit more of a hopped-up commercial venture. Back then, when I was young, the families all knew each other. We all looked out after each other. I even rode my horse into the village on occasion, tied up at the old Siesta Sundry. So you can't really compare the two, but how can I compare it? I don't know. One is one that I enjoyed. One is one I cannot, you know, associate with. I just find it too foreign, too weird.
So for the early part of your life, was Midnight Pass open?
Yes, because I used to go down to the Shark Lab, Eugenie Shark Lab, Eugenie
Eugenie Clark, right.
Yeah, down at the end of what was Blind Pass Road. I think they still call it that. We used to call it Roller Coaster Road. But back then the pass was open, and I used to go down to the Shark Lab and hang out because it was a cool place to be. And the pass was pretty strong in there. She used to be able to bring a boat in and out. And the three tanks that she had there, the shark tanks, were basically just big holes dug in the sand. And she had a couple little outbuildings. And I remember the pass, yes. And Brian Martell, who was one of the shark fishermen back then, he had what was the name of that place? He had a little marina down there. I can't remember the name of it, down south. But, yeah, the pass was roaring back then.
Yeah.
It was probably 10, 15 feet deep.
Yeah.
But I was involved in the closing of the pass, so that's a whole other story.
Talk about the closing of the pass.
Okay, well, as I got to know all these characters in Sarasota, the more outrageous, the more fun, the more creative, the more I loved them. So I got to know the Solomons really well, and I was actually photographing a lot of Sid Solomon's work And I was photographing a lot of the artist's works for publication, wherever they needed it for. And Sid and Annie had a great home, beautiful home there on the pass, next to the Carter family. And that's that. The last 5 years that I was there photographing, the pass started to migrate north. And as it migrated north, it got shallower and shallower, and people were still kind of getting in and out of the pass with their boats, but the skiffs got to be smaller and harder to get through. And then eventually it got down to almost a trickle where it was really just below your knees. I mean, it was only like a foot, maybe a foot and a half of water. And it was drifted so far north that the next storm, I think the Carters and Solomons both feared that something could happen, you know, because their beachfront had lost, you know, quite a bit of sand. And as the pass had drifted north, they were concerned. So the thought was, since the water really isn't flowing and it's almost closing itself, let's kind of block it up. We'll bring some bulldozers in there and block it up. So they piled sand in front of it and then hope that the new pass would be forced in, maybe either by storm or whatever, would open up and become a new pass, not understanding the whole science and what was going on with the pass and how, you know, migration, sands and wind and tides, all that work. So I think they were just hopeful that nothing would happen other than they could just redirect the pass.
Yeah. And they failed to keep the pass open
right.
So, after they closed it.
Yeah. So there was a big controversy about it when the public found out that they had to either got permitted or they had a friend at the county, I don't know, that they wanted to close it. Then the public got involved and said, you know, don't close the pass. A lot of fishermen wanted to use it, et cetera, et cetera. So then it got down to the closing day. I was down there with a couple people. One, I was doing a story. I worked for the Pelican Press out in Siesta Key, which was a small newspaper weekly. And they used to give me free rein to do whatever I wanted, which was great. So I was down there photographing the pass being filled in. And then all of a sudden this other group came, contradictory group came and said, no, we want to open the pass. And they brought shovels and everything else, started digging. And it became this little turf war there for a little while. But anyway, so the counties, for some reason, I don't know what the purpose was other than to try to open the pass. I don't think they had the knowledge of what was happening. So they said, well, you know what? And the Solomons agreed, let's just try and open it. So they brought in some big, heavy equipment, tried to open it, and obviously it didn't work because the migration of the water, the sand, or whatever it was that was blocking the flow just didn't happen. So I think both sides were trying their best to do the right thing, and then it turned into a big political brouhaha. So,
yeah.
And I don't know why Sid Solomon and Carters are still blamed for that. I think it was more than just a bunch of landowners trying to take advantage. I think it was just a natural process, and both people were trying to do the right thing, and both people ended up on opposite sides.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I want to reintroduce our guest. He is J.B. McCourtney, which is how his photography business has been cited. And because I've known Brad for a long time, I refer to him as Brad McCourtney. The Bay Park will host Salsa and Sunsets Community Celebration as part of the third anniversary of the Bay and Hispanic Heritage Month at the Bay. Attendees can learn new dance moves and then put them to practice at a Latino-inspired dance party, including live music by the Grammy-winning Milly Puente Band. The dance lessons are for beginners and seasoned dancers alike. Salsa and Sunsets will take place on Wednesday, October 1st from 6:30 to 8:30 at Bay Park, 1055 Boulevard of the Arts. More information is available at thebaysarasota.org/calendar. So, Brad, what would you like to talk about next?
Well, I'd like to talk just briefly about the Out-of-Door School because it keeps coming up with old-timers that have been here, and there's quite a few of us our age. I'm 75. And some of the new people that associate the Outdoor Academy with the same school. They're two different schools. They always were. And when I was there, it was the Outdoor School. And it was founded by Fenil Harrison and a woman named Gabby. And they based that education and that teaching on the De Crowley method from a Belgian educator. And it was very open and in a progressive sense, much like a Montessori. And a lot of the classes were outside. And as a kid growing there, it was open for experiment, playfulness, but also classic subjects. We even had Latin, which was, you know, something interesting back then. But anyway, all the classes were outside, and I enjoyed it because I've always loved being outside. I still have to be outside most of the day. I can't be inside. So I was so thankful for the years I spent at outdoor school and having a horse, riding in the stables, swimming out in the Gulf. We had a little cafeteria on the Gulf side, and I used to have my pet pelican fly up there and meet me for lunch. My dog would walk back and forth with me between classes in the cafeteria. We used to write for a newspaper. We would have all sorts of sporting events, but they weren't your typical sports. They were soccer or, you know, hide the ball kind of thing. Or we would go out for the summer and spend a summer out at Myakka State Park, and we would do a camp out. And a couple of those, my early heroes, were people like Frank Meyer, who was a big part of that. He was a PE coach and the, kind of the official outdoorsman for the school. So outdoor school spent a lot of time influencing me in my kind of early life, but also it kind of stuck with me. So Outdoor Academy, Outdoor School are two different things. And I think what's going to happen here shortly is that Outdoor School on Siesta Key, the original campus, has been on the market for a while. I got a feeling that it's going to be taken down shortly. And its history will be history.
So what do you remember about Hurricane Donna?
Hurricane Donna, yeah. A lot of people, it's interesting because mine is more of like a firsthand knowledge, but a lot of people say, oh, it was just a minor hurricane. It kind of skirted the coast. It didn't really do a lot. I think it was only a Category 2 or something when it passed by. But it did something unique, which has just happened with with Helene and Milton. It flooded the area greatly. We had storm surge unlike we'd ever seen. That was 1960, and I remember living on the Key, and the whole island was underwater. And I remember being on top of my mother's car and diving into the water. So Hurricane Donna to me was about, I was, 10 years old, was more about the chaos and the sudden, flood that came. It was like the big flood, and there weren't that many people on the island back then. So it wasn't like a disaster in that sense. It was more about this huge wave of water that nobody had ever seen before.
And so that was the first time that Siesta Key experienced storm surge?
During my lifetime, yes. Okay. There was a couple. There was a small one called No Name Storm back in the, I think, 80s that flooded Siesta Key. I lived on Avenida del Norte near the Grand Canal, and we actually got a flood at that time, and I canoed all the way from the house into Siesta Village. The dogs stay with me. The family always leaves. I always stay with the hurricanes because I always feel there's always something I can do or something I need to save. I never felt the threat from the wind. It's always been about the water with me. I love the wind. I love storms. I used to walk the beach only when we had the biggest storm. So the storm to me was never the big fear. It was always the water. So, yeah, Siesta Key, I think the biggest one that I can remember, the flood, was Hurricane Donna. And then obviously these last two, Hurricane Helene and Milton, which I stayed for too, which almost cost me my life, but that's okay.
So tell us about the house that you lived in before Hurricane Helene.
Okay.
And it was a Sarasota School of Architecture house?
No.
No, okay.
So let me go back a little bit. So there's two big houses, not two big houses, two periods of time that were long, 25, almost 30 years, I think, now. I lived at Del Norte, raised the kids when they're little, and when several of them went off to college, my father had died. That was 1994, and I bought a home on the north end. Actually, we were living in Brazil, but it gets off to another story. But I came back. We came back as a family to Siesta Key and bought this house from a man named Ben Baldwin's estate. Actually, I knew him personally prior to buying the home. He was a well-known decorator, designer from New York, Chicago. He lived out on Long Island. He designed and built a lot of contemporary stuff. He was friends with the Iams or Eames. I can't remember how you pronounce their name. The designers, the mid-century group of people. And he was well-known at the time for his work. Well, he designed this little winter home. It was so sweet and so cute on a little private lagoon. On Siesta Key, and his sister and I knew each other because I had been working on a book of Ben's. Ben, prior to his death, was in the process of publishing a book, of autobiography of design, he called it. And when Ben died, I was actually living in Brazil, and his sister contacted us about buying the house because she knew how much I loved it. I'd spent time with Ben, and I'd photographed the home for different magazines. So Ben was kind of like a hero to me as well. He was another one of these characters that came along. There's so many on Siesta Key over the years that have all gone, that kind of reached out and kind of took me in and said, you know, hey, if you ever need to stop by, you want to talk, you want to do whatever. So he was a great person. So we lived in this house from 94 up until about 8 months ago when we lost it in Helene, and that was because of title search.
Okay, so tell us how it sounded like you were very attached to both the house and the garden,
right,
on the property.
So Ben Baldwin was a designer, but he was also a landscape architect, and he had this passion for gardens. He lived up north. Obviously, Florida to him was kind of exotic. So he created this kind of unique garden system, using planter boxes, walkways, little hidden rooms, I don't know what you call them, different areas of the yard property that you would not normally suspect in Florida. So most of the Sarasota School people really dealt with the building themselves, the design of the building. Ben incorporated the garden with the property, which made this whole thing more unique. So his gardens were just as much of the design factor as his house was. So when I took it on, it was interesting. I knew nothing about gardening. My father was a gardener in his later years, and I used to go visit him, and he and I weren't very close. But anyway, he would say to things like, I can't talk now. I got to take care of the garden. So I'd have to follow him around the garden. So the irony there was that when he passed, I got this property. I became a gardener. So that was kind of interesting. Ben had two gardeners, usually full-time, planting and reshaping the design, and he had an aesthetic of this Japanese aesthetic of a kind of a minimalist design, and I tried to carry that throughout. And so the 30 years we lived in that house up until this last year, I tried to keep all the original designs and character of the house. Didn't sell the washing machine he installed, didn't sell the stove. Everything in that house was Ben's, including some Matisse prints that were up on the walls.
Okay, and then what happened during Hurricane Helene?
Okay, so first notice is that you get hurricanes approaching, and then you usually have a couple of days to think it out. My wife and usually the kids or the family or the dog or whatever, my wife usually panics like most people. I'm not giving her any fault for that. And they have to leave and go stay in a hotel, and I say, well, you know, I'm staying. So my family are used to me saying I'm staying. So I stayed and wasn't really expecting much from Helene because Helene was kind of wiping the coast. It was kind of going up the side. It wasn't coming to direct hit. But I did notice the storm surge behind it because the backside of any storm or the underneath of any storm approaching from the Gulf usually is the underside or the backside that where you're going to get the water. We had a high tide coming. And I suspected this could be the year that we get flooded. We'd been flooded in the garden. I've been losing some plantings year after year, and every year it's been rising a little bit. So I thought, well, I'm going to stay again, and I'll see what I can do. If I need to lift furniture, I will. If I need to save our scrapbook here, I'll need to do that. I need to put this up. Well, what happened is it got me about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Next thing I know, the water was a foot deep. And then within an hour, it was 2 feet deep. And then by the time 7:30 started getting dark, it was up to my chest. So at that point, I was, you know, frustrated, not frustrated, but a little stressed out. I was trying to put things up, and everything I put up would fall off and floating in the water. And I'm wandering around with a flashlight in my mouth and at this point swimming and trying to save some black and white prints, trying to save anything I thought was important, but I couldn't. At that point, you don't even know what's important. So my son from New Maine called down and wanted to make sure that Paul was all right. He called me Paul and said he called the sheriff's department. They wanted to come out and check on me. Well, they couldn't get out on the island. So anyway, there's a word out on some program. I guess he went on Facebook or some of those social media platforms and started talking about me and how I needed some help to get out of there. And so we had a neighbor who lived in one of those big mega mansions down the street. I lived on Bay Island. That's where the house was. There was a doctor down there that had a large home, and the first 10, 12 feet of their home is generally a garage or whatever. And that was underwater, but, you know, all the living space above could be lived in. Most of those people on the street had generators. So he canoed down or paddled down and started yelling for me to come because there was no power. All the power had blown out. And got me in the canoe and the kayak, I mean, and we paddled back to his house, and that's where I stayed for the night.
And so you kind of, the house was, had 5 feet of water in it?
I would say 4 feet.
Water in it. And what did you lose?
I lost everything. Everything that could float. I mean, if anything was above my chest, I would say it was all right. It's like some of the artwork on the wall that I collected some great artworks over the years. Things that meant a lot to me. Most of that was okay, but everything from, you know, I would say from my chest down, which included all the cabinets, everything in, you know, in storage, any kind of rolling cabinet or any kind of shelving, anything like that, or, you know, and things like my libraries, all that stuff, all my books and scrapbooks, everything, all that went underwater, and I didn't have enough speed and sense and didn't prep enough to find places to put it up, because every time I put something up, 20 minutes later, I go into another room, and let's say on the bed was floating, and it would flip over. So everything was on the bed, floated, flipped over, and it was all in the water. So it was just to the point where I had to give up. I couldn't – there was nothing I could do. So we lost a lot. It took me a little while to get over that. I'm over that now. I live in town now. And I think it was – I'm trying to remember his name now. Who wrote the book, The Gulf?
Jack Davis, yeah.
So I run into, I don't know if you all know the book, The Gulf, but it's a Pulitzer Prize winner. Jack Davis wrote a great book. I ran into him about 4 months ago, and he talked to me. We talked a little bit about The Gulf, and I thought that was so sweet because he spent a little time with me. And then he finally, the basic thing was that, you know, nobody should live on the island, and I agree with him. So his whole theory of thought and philosophy was, you know, there shouldn't be development on the island. So in a strong way, I've always loved the Gulf of Mexico, and another way, the Gulf of Mexico took everything away. So I have no qualms about it. It's not that it's anybody's fault other than me just living on the island and taking that chance.
Yeah, so the climate crisis is increasing sea level,
mm-hmm.
And you lived on a mangrove rimmed bayou
lagoon.
And you know,
we were only a foot above sea level, so
okay.
We had a seawall that was built in 1948, so you can imagine what that looked like. It was right up, you know.
Yeah,
it was, you know.
And sea level has risen,
of course,
a lot.
Yeah,
so since every 1948
year, we were in that house 30 years, so every year I would notice every year 2 or 3 inches higher every year, every winter.
Yeah,
you know, the water would drop, and then by August, September, I started noticing the water started coming over the seawall, but the house is probably graded maybe a foot above that.
Okay.
So it would creep across every year, and every year I'd lose some other exotic plant that I'd planted or whatever. So every year I started noticing. About 2 years ago, I said to Sandy, my wife, and I talked to the family, you know, we should sell the house. I think this isn't going to last much longer, because I had noticed it. I'm not an environmentalist, but when you see something physically every year, and you're getting more and more water in your yard, particularly salt water, it's not good. So We didn't do it 2 years ago. We didn't sell. And I kept saying, you know, maybe we'll get lucky. I love this house. I don't want to leave. There it was.
Yeah, there it was. Yeah.
There it was. I just saw it coming over the wall and just kept coming.
Yeah.
And it didn't come in a massive wave. It came very slowly. It was very surreal. It was like the wind was howling, which I love. You know, I get excited with the wind. So I like to stand outside and watch the wind. So the wind's howling, the trees are bending, and the water's coming very, very slowly, not in a push, a heavy wave. It was coming like, just like you were pouring a glass of water. It was very strange, very, very strange and surreal, because you kept thinking you could deal with it, but you couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, and so a lot of properties on Siesta Key were impacted by the high tide of the surge of Helene. And Helene was like over 100 miles out in the Gulf of Mexico.
Heading north, yeah.
Yeah, heading north and sort of parallel to the coast.
Parallel, and really it was the backside of the storm that really did the damage, because that's where the wind comes from, the south, and the south southeast blowing west. I mean, sorry, southwest blowing east. And that's where all that storm surge came, because I kept saying to myself all these years that most hurricanes usually come south of us. So if they come from the Gulf and they, let's say, go into Charlotte Harbor like Ian did or something like that, then we get the north side of the storm, which blows the water out of the bay.
Out of the bay,
and
right.
I remember going driving downtown one time and seeing the whole bay was just muck, mud, and nothing. There's no water there. And I think that was Ian.
Yeah, I read that people saw manatees stranded on the bay bottom when the winds of Ian were on the north side and they were blowing off offshore.
And even our lagoon in the back was emptied. I would say within 2 or 3 hours, the beginning of the storm was empty. I'm looking at maybe 8 feet of water in the lagoon. And it was just, it was maybe a puddle down at the bottom. That's what it was, yeah.
So tell us about your history of fishing.
Okay, so as a kid, because I loved the outdoors and nature and all that, I didn't have any friends. I had one close friend. But anyway, I spent most of my time by myself, and I had a little boat. So all my heroes were like old outdoors people, outdoorsmen. And one in particular was a guy named Dick Meyer, who lived on the Key. He was an old scuba diver, and he did diving instruction and all that. And his family still lived on the Key, and up until recently. I think some of the boys are still around. But anyway, he was a fisherman, and he had an old Willys Jeep, and he used to drive around the village when I was young, and, you know, 5 or 6, 8 years old, I remember him on his Willys Jeep. And he was always fishing, always had fish in the back, because, you know, old Willie's had just an open thing. But he also had a pet pelican. So that was how I got involved with the pelican thing, because I had talked to him about his pelican. He'd sit at the hardware store with a pelican sitting on the tailgate and a bunch of fish sitting in the back of the Willie's. And I'm going, oh, my God, this is what I want to be. And here I was, a kid, you know, still shooting cap guns, but wishing I was some kind of cowboy with a Willie's Jeep and a pelican.
Yeah.
So fishing started then. And then I got so excited by it that it became this quest not just to catch the fish but to see the environment they were in. I was always interested in how oyster bars worked, how the tides worked around the oyster bar, or how they worked on a pass. So I would set myself up and I would look at the tide charts, not wanting to be a commercial fisherman, but just trying to decide and best way for fish and to kind of look at them. And I'd spend more time kind of hanging out and looking at, visioning this whole scenario more than I was fishing. But yes, then fishing obviously was a part of it too, because I caught some good fish back then. Most of them released. I even got to a period where I was shooting mullet with bow and arrow. So I had a canoe back then and I would shoot bow and arrow, but the kids all knew this. I raised the kids, especially over at Del Norte. Eating from the whatever we could find concept. So I was catching a lot of mullet. We'd fry it up in the back or, you know, smoke it. And I would take sea grapes and I'd make jam out of it, or coquinas. I tried to make soup a couple of times. I'd get a turtle every now and then. I caught out east of town, mud turtle. and we'd chop the head off and eat them. So the kids grew up, you know, just, you know, Dad, what's Dad bringing home today? So I think it scared my wife, but yeah, I've always had that interest. And that comes from, again, a person named Frank Myers, a different Meyer, from out-of-door school, because he taught me about being an outdoorsman, but, you know, that kind of early concept of an outdoorsman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Knowing the wildlife and, you know, yeah. surviving with the wildlife, yeah.
Yeah.
So that fishing was a big part of my life. I grew up, it was one of my hobbies and my thing as a child and as a young teen up until the point I went to England. And when I came back, it changed again.
Okay. And do you want to promote the J.B. McCourtney portrait?
I wish I could promote it, Julie. I'm not a promoter.
Okay.
But what I'd love to do is my big thing, I was going to get this book published, right? It was going to be a serious book. It was going to be a coffee table book. And then I was going to go around the state. I was going to rent one of these kind of pop-up stands that you could do, you know, like at craft shows. And I was going to go around in the interior and try to get people, the average person out there in the interior or let's say Myakka City or whatever, and just set up a little pop-up and just try and sell them on the book or sell them about the people or sell them about, you know, do you remember Harvey Keene? You remember this and that? And try to share this book just at the cost of the book. I wasn't going to try to promote it more than I just wanted to share it. So I'd love to share the idea, the concept, Sarasota County and the Sarasota County resources, historical resources were very good to me. They helped me put this exhibit up. It was up for 8 years, hard to believe. And there was some little bit of controversy behind some of it. But anyway, it stayed up for 8 years.
And it so came, this was in the hallway on the...
The terrace building.
In the terrace building right. on the way to right. the tax collector's
right.
office.
There's 41 portraits.
Yep.
And I had maybe a few more. But they were all up there, good and bad. And they all had little narratives. And I felt so bad because the narrative's so poorly written. But I didn't care, because I was more interested in the portrait. I was just excited to share. So that little bit of dyslexia showed up in some of those narratives. But they only gave me 5 days, I think, to pull those narratives, because I had written pages and pages and pages on each person and had quite a bit of background on most subjects. So I had 5 days to pull together all these little short narratives. So I had sat in Denny's for 5 nights, and they gave me – not Denny's, but yeah, it was Denny's. 5 nights with a little back table, and I had to handwrite these five nights of narratives. So that went up with the portraits, and I was very thankful to the historical resources. Heidi Connor is what the archivist for that. She's still here in town. She does great work. Muldani, what's her name, Mulhaney? Lori Muldani.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lori Muldani, who is head of the historical resources of Sweetheart, she took good care of me and got the city and the county to work together with it. And there was a couple other people involved as well with historical resources. Again, I really appreciate with them for what they did. My thought is that upon my death, that group of portraits with a few other things are going to be going to the historical resources for public, you know, for public access. So at this point, I've just walked away really from a lot of the photography and all of that, because I'm kind of had to transition after losing the home and everything and losing all the background material to just kind of trying to relax and find some kind of solace some other way. So I'm hitting the water again in a different way and enjoying being out on the water again. I'm also volunteering for a couple of different conservation groups, which gets me back out to the interior. And so the book has become a sitting on the shelf project. But it will come back. It will be back with historical resources. And hopefully it'll stay there forever and ever.
Yeah. So you also include in your gallery of portraits on your website photographs from Cuba and Brazil. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
So what I did was, when I was in England, I studied what was called back then advertising photography. That was what my degree of photography was from the Medway College of Design. It was strictly a photography design course. And I learned large format, meaning that the large plate cameras, the cameras you put on a tripod, images upside down, use a head cloth and a sheet of film. So by the time I got back, I already had a camera made for me, a larger one. And so my whole project with this was to use strictly the 8x10 field camera, a tape recorder, and to start documenting Florida. But as it got to be bigger and bigger, and I lived in Brazil for a while, I went to Brazil, and I started to do the same there. And then I also spent two lengthy visits in Cuba, did the same there, and got an interpreter. You know, I went out in the streets and photographed different people and what, you know, what their life was like in this one section of Havana called Jesus Maria. And I lived with a family there. It was very sweet. And did the same in Brazil. But in Brazil, I did more of a field study. So I did head to the south, all the way down to the Pantanal, which is the border area of, what's the name of that place? I don't know. It's Pantanal. Pantanal borders on the, can't think of the country. Blanking out.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry about that. But anyway, I covered a lot of Brazil. I didn't do the Amazon or the northern regions. I did mostly the middle parts of Brazil. Brazil's huge. It's larger than the United States. So I covered some of that and did the same. So I had black and white portraits all done with a field camera for three different countries, Florida, Brazil, and Cuba.
And so how would people access that?
Well, ideally, this is where I need my kids' help.
Okay.
They need to get motivated.
Okay.
I would like to put this all into a large book.
Yeah.
With as much information as I can get and accomplish. Because they're all related, because all of them are very similar but very different. And each one covers well-known people, unknown people, workers, kind of goofballs, odd people, eccentric, talented, unique. I don't know how to put them. Each one of the portrait series I did in those three different countries, all the same, but very different in style, but in similarities, such as the black and white vertical format portrait.
Okay, and so they're black and white, and we can put the link to that.
The website, sure. I'd gladly have anybody go to. I even have a business card. I try to hand them out to people, and people say, "I don't want your card."
Yeah.
What's your?
And so, what's the website?
Website is very difficult. It's jbmccourtney.com.
jbmccourtney.com.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
No period. Just JB. I mean, even my son said, "You got to get rid of the periods. You know, you got to get contemporary. You got to be real here." And I said, "Okay." So I've tried to be about as updated as I can get.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it shows early work. It shows some of my commercial work. It shows some of my magazine work. Where I made my money was editorial. I had two agencies in New York. I submitted a lot of labor issue stuff. I did a lot of stuff with social issues, labor issues, also personal projects. But the portraits always meant more to me than anything else.
You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton or listen online. Today's show, number 69, featured local photographer Brad J.B. McCourtney. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at WSLR Archives. Go to archive.wslr.org. If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group Our Changing Environment. This is a great place to hear recent shows. Tune in next week at 9 a.m. for the Healthy Living Hour with Dr. Rebecca Acosta. And tune in at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today on September 30th for the next episode of Our Changing Environment. If you're interested in local public affairs, tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. for The Detail, hosted by Kathy Antunes. And don't forget to check out the live music, public affairs, and other special events at Fogartyville on Lemon Lane, just 6 blocks north of Main Street here in Sarasota. Right now, stay tuned for Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! At 10 a.m. Our theme music is Vicky's Vamp, composed and performed by John Lambie.
Yay, Amy. Thank you.